Chapter 11. And foot. Not until he was secured would they let me get to him. I flung myself upon his poor insulted form, and cried my grief out upon his breast, while my father and all my family scoffed at me, and heaped threats and shameful epithets upon him. He bore his ill usage with a tranquil dignity which endeared him to me more than ever, and made me proud and happy to suffer with him and for him. I heard my father order that the elders of the tribe be called together to try my Kalila for his life. What? I said, before any search has been made for the lost hook? Lost hook? They all shouted, in derision. And my father added, mockingly, stand back, everybody, and be properly serious. She is going to hunt up that lost hook. Oh, without doubt she will find it. Whereat they all laughed again. I was not disturbed, I had no fears, no doubts. I said, it is for you to laugh now, it is your turn. But ours is coming, wait and see. I got a rag lamp. I thought I should find that miserable thing in one little moment, and I set about that matter with such confidence, that those people grew grace, beginning to suspect that perhaps they had been too hasty. But alas and alas! Oh, the bitterness of that search! There was deep silence, while one might count his fingers 10 or 12 times, then my heart began to sink, and around me the mockings began again, and grew steadily louder and more assured, until at last, when I gave up, they burst into volley after volley of cruel laughter. None will ever know what I suffered then. But my love was my support and my strength, and I took my rightful place at my Kalila's side, and put my arm about his neck, and whispered in his ear, saying, you are innocent, my own, that I know, but say it to me yourself, for my comfort, then I can bear whatever is in store for us. He answered, as surely as I stand upon the brink of death at this moment, I am innocent. Be comforted, then, O bruised heart. Be at peace, O thou breath of my nostrils, life of my life. Now then, let the elders come. And as I said the words there was a gathering sound of crunching snow outside, and then a vision of stooping forms filing in at the door. The elders. My father formally accused the prisoner, and detailed the happenings of the night. He said that the watchman was outside the door, and that in the house were none, but the family and the stranger. All the family steal their own property? He paused. The elders sat silent many minutes. At last, one after another said to his neighbor, this looks bad for the stranger, sorrowful words for me to hear. Then my father sat down. Oh, miserable, miserable me! At that very moment I could have proved my darling innocent, but I did not know it. The chief of the court asked, is there any here to defend the prisoner? I rose and said, why should he steal that hook, or any or all of them? In another day he would have been heir to the whole. I stood waiting. There was a long silence, the steam from the many breaths rising about me like a fog. At last one elder after another nodded his head slowly several times, and muttered, there is force in what the child has said. Oh, the heart lift that was in those words. So transient, but, oh, so precious. I sat down. If any would say further, let him speak now, or after hold his peace, said the chief of the court. My father rose and said, in the night a form passed by me in the gloom, going toward the treasury and presently returned. I think, now, it was the stranger. Oh, I was like to swoon. I had supposed that that was my secret. Not the grip of the great ice god himself could have dragged it out of my heart. The chief of the court said sternly to my poor Kalila, speak. Kalila hesitated, then answered, it was one. I could not sleep for thinking of the beautiful hooks. I went there, and kissed them and fondled them, to appease my spirit, and drown it in a harmless joy, then I put them back. I may have dropped one, but I stole none. Oh, a fatal admission to make in such a place. There was an awful hush. I knew he had pronounced his own doom, and that all was over. On every face you could see the words hieroglyph, colon, it is a confession. And paltry, lame, and thin. I sat drawing in my breath in faint gasps and waiting. Presently, I heard the solemn words I knew were coming, and each word, as it came, was a knife in my heart. It is the command of the court that the accused be subjected to the trial by water. Oh, curses be upon the head of him who brought trial by water to our land. It came, generations ago, from some far country that lies none knows where. Before that our fathers used augury and other unsure methods of trial, and doubtless some poor guilty creatures escaped with their lives sometimes. But it is not so with trial by water, which is an invention by wiser men than we poor ignorant savages are. By it the innocent are proved innocent, without doubt or question, for they drown, and the guilty are proven guilty with the same certainty, for they do not drown. My heart was breaking in my bosom, for I said, he is innocent, and he will go down under the waves and I shall never see him more. I never left his side after that. I mourned in his arms all the precious hours, and he poured out the deep stream of his love upon me, and oh, I was so miserable and so happy. At last, they tore him from me, and I followed sobbing after them, and saw them fling him into the sea. Then I covered my face with my hands. Agony? Oh, I know the deepest deeps of that word. The next moment the people burst into a shout of malicious joy, and I took away my hands, startled. Oh, bitter sight, he was swimming. My heart turned instantly to stone, to ice. I said, he was guilty, and he lied to me. I turned my back in scorn, and went my way homeward. They took him far out to sea, and set him on an iceberg that was drifting southward in the great waters. Then my family came home, and my father said to me, your thief sent his dying message to you, saying, tell her I am innocent, and that all the days and all the hours and all the minutes, while I starve and perish, I shall love her, and think of her, and bless the day that gave me sight of her sweet face. Apostrophe quite pretty, even poetical. I said, he is dirt, let me never hear mention of him again. And oh, to think he was innocent all the time. 9 months, 9 dull, sad months went by, and at last, came the day of the great annual sacrifice, when all the maidens of the tribe wash their faces and comb their hair. With the first sweep of my comb out came the fatal fish hook from where it had been all those months nestling, and I fell fainting into the arms of my remorseful father. Groaning, he said, we murdered him, and I shall never smile again. He has kept his word. Listen. From that day to this not a month goes by that I do not comb my hair. But oh, where is the good of it all now? Apostrophe, so ended the poor maid's humble little tale, whereby we learn that since $100 million in New York and 22 fish hooks on the border of the Arctic Circle represent the same financial supremacy, a man in straitened circumstances is a fool to stay in New York when he can buy 10 cents worth of fish hooks and emigrate. Christian Science and the Book of Mrs. Eddy. It is the first time since the dawn days of creation that a voice has gone crashing through space with such placid and complacent confidence and command. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I, this last summer, when I was on my way back to Vienna from the appetite cure in the mountains, I fell over a cliff in the twilight, and broke some arms and legs and one thing or another, and by good luck was found by some peasants who had lost an ass, and they carried me to the nearest habitation, which was one of those large, low, thatch-roofed farmhouses, with apartments in the garret for the family, and a cunning little porch under the deep gable decorated with boxes of bright-colored flowers and cats. On the ground floor a large and light sitting room, separated from the milch cattle apartment by a partition, and in the front yard rose stately and fine the wealth and pride of the house, the manure pile. That sentence is Germanic, and shows that I am acquiring that sort of mastery of the art and spirit of the language which enables a man to travel all day in one sentence without changing cars. There was a village a mile away, and a horse doctor lived there, but there was no surgeon. It seemed a bad outlook. Mine was distinctly a surgery case. Then it was remembered that a lady from Boston was summering in that village, and she was a Christian Science doctor and could cure anything. So she was sent for. It was night by this time, and she could not conveniently come, but sent word that it was no matter, there was no hurry, she would give me absent treatment now, and come in the morning. Meantime she begged me to make myself tranquil and comfortable, and remember that there was nothing the matter with me. I thought there must be some mistake. Did you tell her I walked off a cliff 75 feet high? Yes. And struck a boulder at the bottom and bounced? Yes. And struck another one and bounced again? Yes. And struck another one and bounced yet again? Yes. And broke the boulders?
Yes.
That accounts for it. She is thinking of the boulders. Why didn't you tell her I got hurt too?
I did.
I told her what you told me to tell her. That you were now, but an incoherent series of compound fractures extending from your scalp lock to your heels, and that the comminuted projections caused you to look like a hat rack. And it was after this that she wished me to remember that there was nothing the matter with me?
Those were her words.
I do not understand it. I believe he has not diagnosed the case with sufficient care. Did she look like a person who was theorizing, or did she look like one who has fallen off precipices herself, and brings to the aid of abstract science the confirmation of personal experience? It was too large a contract for the Steubenmädchen's vocabulary. She couldn't call the hand. I allowed the subject to rest there, and asked for something to eat and smoke, and something hot to drink, and a basket to pile my legs in, and another capable person to come and help me curse the time away, but I could not have any of these things.
Why?
She said you would need nothing at all. But I am hungry and thirsty, and in desperate pain. She said you would have these delusions, but must pay no attention to them. She wants you to particularly remember that there are no such things as hunger, and thirst and pain.
She does she?
It is what she said.
Does she see Moby in full and functional possession of her intellectual plant, such as it is?
Do they let her run at large, or do they tie her up?
Tie her up?
There, good night, run along. You are a good girl, but your mental gesture is not arranged for light and airy conversation. Leave me to my delusions.
Two, it was a night of anguish. Of course, at least I supposed it was, for it had all the symptoms of it, but it passed at last, and the Christian Scientist came, and I was glad. She was middle-aged, and large and bony and erect, and had an austere face and a resolute jaw and a Roman beak, and was a widow in the third degree, and her name was Fuller. I was eager to get to business and find relief, but she was distressingly deliberate. She unpinned and unhooked, and uncoupled her upholsteries one by one, abolished the wrinkles with a flirt of her hand, and hung the articles up, peeled off her gloves and disposed of them, got a book out of her handbag, then drew a chair to the bedside, descended into it without hurry, and I hung out my tongue. She said, with pity but without passion, "Return it to its receptacle. We deal with the mind only, not with its dumb servants."
I could not offer my pulse, because the connection was broken, but she detected the apology before I could word it, and indicated by a negative tilt of her head that the pulse was another dumb servant that he had no use for.
Then I thought I would tell her my symptoms and how I felt so that she would understand the case. But that was another inconsequence. She did not need to know those things. Moreover, my remark about how I felt was an abuse of language, a misapplication of terms one does not feel, apostrophe she explained. There is no such thing as feeling. Therefore, to speak of a non-existent thing as existent as a contradiction. Matter has no existence. Nothing exists but mind. The mind cannot feel pain, it can only imagine it. But if it hurts, just the same, it doesn't. A thing which is unreal cannot exercise the functions of reality. Pain is unreal, hence pain cannot hurt. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.